such vast quantities of water and matter from the ground that the soil dropped all around them, subsiding far enough to reveal the uppermost levels of their roots, which would burn in the incandescence and take the full great year to regrow. It was dusk, the short time in a short day when the rapidly spinning planet left the bright yellow dwarf dropping beyond the horizon. Gergé breathed deeply. There was no smell of burning. The air seemed quite clear, and a couple of planets in the Akronidal system shone in the sky. Nevertheless, Gergé knew there was sufficient dust in the atmosphere to forever block out most of the stars in the sky and leave the huge wheel that was the main galaxy blurred and indistinct. Not remotely as breathtaking as it was when viewed from beyond the planet's hazed covering of gas. He sat in a tiny garden near the top of the fortress, so that he could see over the summits of most of the cinderbuds. He was level with the fruit-bearing heads of the tallest trees. The fruit pods, each about the size of a curled-up child, were full of what was basically ethyl alcohol. When the incandescence arrived, some would drop and some would stay hanging there. All would burn. A shiver ran through Gergé when he thought about it. Approximately 70 days to go, they said. Anybody sitting where he was now when the firefront arrived would be roasted alive, water sprays or not. Radiated heat alone would cook you. The garden he was sitting in would go. The wooden bench he was sitting on would be taken inside, behind the thick stone and the metal and fireglass shutters. Gardens in the deeper courtyards would survive, though they would have to be dug out from some of the wind-blown ash. The people would be safe in the drenched castle or the deep shelters, unless they had been very foolish and were caught outside. It had happened, he'd been told. He saw Fleer Imsaho flying over the trees toward him. The machine had been given permission to fly off by itself, as long as it told the authorities where it was going and agreed to be fitted with a position monitor. Obviously there wasn't anything on Akronidal the Empire considered especially militarily sensitive. The drone hadn't been too happy with the conditions, but reckoned it would go mad cooped up in the castle. So it agreed. This had been its first expedition.
Sure now, Gergé?
Hello, drone. Bird watching?
Flying fish. Thought I'd start with the oceans.
Going to take a look at the fire?
Not yet. I hear you're playing Lotenya's Crowo next.
In 4 days. They say he's very good.
He is. He's also one of the people who know all about the culture.
Gergé glared at the machine. What?
There are never fewer than 8 people in the Empire who know where the culture comes from, roughly what size it is, and our level of technological development.
Really? Gergé said through his teeth.
For the last 200 years, the Emperor, the Chief of Naval Intelligence, and the 6 Star Marshals have been appraised of the power and extent of the culture. They don't want anybody else to know. Their choice, not ours. They're frightened. It's understandable.
Drone, Gergé said loudly. Has it occurred to you I might be getting a little sick of being treated like a child all the time? Why the hell couldn't you just tell me that?
Juno, we only wanted to make things easier for you. Why complicate things by telling you that a few people did know, when there was no real likelihood of your ever coming into any but the most fleeting contact with any of them? Frankly, you'd never have been told at all if you hadn't got to the stage of playing against one of these people. No need for you to know. We're just trying to help you, really. I thought I'd tell you in case Crowo said something during the course of the game which puzzled you and upset your concentration.
Well, I wish you cared as much about my temper as you do about my concentration, Gergé said, getting up and going to lean on the parapet at the end of the garden.
I'm very sorry,
the drone said, without a trace of contrition. Gergé waved one hand. Never mind. I take it Crowo's in naval intelligence, then, not the Office of Cultural Exchange?
Correct. Officially, his post does not exist. But everybody in court knows the highest-placed player who's the least bit devious is offered the job.
I thought cultural exchange was a funny place for somebody that good.
Well, Crowo's had the intelligence job for 3 great years, and some people reckon he could have been emperor if he'd really wanted. But he prefers to stay where he is. He'll be a difficult opponent.
So everybody keeps telling me, Gergé said, then frowned and looked toward the fading light on the horizon. What's that? He said. Did you hear that? It came again, a long, haunting, plaintive cry from far away, almost drowned by the quiet rustling of the cinderbud canopy. The faint sound rose in a still quiet but chilling crescendo, a scream that died away slowly. Gergé shivered for the second time that evening. "What is that?" he whispered. The drone sidled closer.
"What? Those calls?" it said.
"Yes," Gergay said, listening to the faint sound as it came and went on the soft, warm wind, wavering out of the darkness over the rustling heads of the giant cinderbuds.
"Animals,"
Fleer Imsaho said, dimly silhouetted against the last fractions of light in the western sky.
"Big carnivores called Troche, mostly. Six-legged. You saw some from the Emperor's personal menagerie on the night of the ball, remember?"
Gergay nodded, still listening, fascinated, to the cries of the distant beasts. How do they escape the incandescence?
"Troche ran ahead, almost up to the fire line during the previous great month. The ones you're listening to couldn't run fast enough to escape even if they started now. They've been trapped and penned so they can be hunted for sport. That's why they're howling like that. They know the fire's coming, and they want to get away."
Gergay said nothing, head turned to catch the faint sound of the doomed animals. Fleer Imsaho waited for a minute or so, but the man did not move or ask anything else. The machine backed off, to return to Gergay's rooms. Just before it went through the door into the castle, it looked back at the man, standing clutching the stone parapet at the far end of the little garden. He was crouched a little, head forward, motionless. It was quite dark now, and ordinary human eyes could not have picked out the quiet figure. The drone hesitated, then disappeared into the fortress. Gergay hadn't thought Azad was the sort of game you could have an off day in, certainly not an off 20 days. Discovering that it was came as a great disappointment. He'd studied many of Lo Tenya Kruo's past games, and had looked forward to playing the intelligence chief. The Apex's style was exciting, far more flamboyant, if occasionally more erratic, than that of any of the other top-flight players. It ought to have been a challenging, enjoyable match, but it wasn't. It was hateful, embarrassing, ignominious. Gergay annihilated Kruo. The burly, at first rather jovial and unconcerned-seeming Apex made some awful, simple errors, and some that resulted from genuinely inspired, even brilliant play, but which in the end were just as disastrous. Sometimes, Gergay knew, you came up against somebody who, just by the way they played, caused you a lot more problems than they ought to. And sometimes, too, you found a game in which everything went badly, no matter how hard you tried, and regardless of your most piercing insights and incisive moves. The chief of naval intelligence seemed to have both problems at once. Gergi's game style might have been designed to cause Kruo problems, and the Apex's luck was almost non-existent. Gergay felt real sympathy for Kruo, who was obviously more upset at the manner than the fact of the defeat. They were both glad when it was over. Fleer Imsaho watched the man play during the closing stages of the match. It read each move as they appeared on the screen, and what it saw was something less like a game and more like an operation. Gergay, the game player, the Morat, was taking his opponent apart. The Apex was playing badly, true, but Gergay was off-handedly brilliant anyway. There was a callousness in his play that was new too, something the drone had been half expecting, but was still surprised to see so soon and so completely. It read the signs the man's body and face held: annoyance, pity, anger, sorrow. And it read the play too, and saw nothing remotely similar. All it read was the ordered fury of a player working the boards and the pieces, the cards and the rules, like the familiar controls of some omnipotent machine. Another change, it thought. The man had altered, slipped deeper into the game and the society. It had been warned this might happen. One reason was that Gergay was speaking Iachic all the time. Fleer Imsaho was always a little dubious about trying to be so precise about human behavior, but it had been briefed that when culture people didn't speak Moraine for a long time, and did speak another language, they were liable to change. They acted differently. They started to think in that other language. They lost the carefully balanced interpretive structure of the culture language, left its subtle shifts of cadence, tone, and rhythm behind for, in virtually every case, something much cruder. Moraine was a synthetic language, designed to be phonetically and philosophically as expressive as the pan-human speech apparatus and the pan-human brain would allow. Fleer Imsaho suspected it was overrated, but smarter minds than it had dreamed Moraine up, and 10 millennia later, even the most rarefied and superior minds still thought highly of the language, so it supposed it had to defer to their superior understanding. One of the minds who'd briefed it had even compared Moraine to Azad. That really was fanciful. But Fleer Imsaho had taken the point behind the hyperbole. Iachik was an ordinary, evolved language, with rooted assumptions which substituted sentimentality for compassion and aggression for cooperation. A comparatively innocent and sensitive soul like Gyrge was bound to pick up some of its underlying ethical framework if he spoke it all the time. So now the man played like one of those carnivores he'd been listening to, stalking across the board, setting up traps and diversions and killing grounds, pouncing, pursuing, bringing down, consuming, absorbing. Fleer Imsaho shifted inside its disguise as though uncomfortable, then switched the screen off. The day after Gyrgi's game with Kroo ended, he received a long letter from Chamlis Amalkne. He sat in his room and watched the old drone. It showed him views of Chark while it gave him the latest news. Professor Baruelal still in retreat, Halfless pregnant, Alt's half away on a cruise with her first love, but coming back within the year to continue at the university. Chamlis still working on its history book. Gyrge sat, watching and listening. Contact had censored the communication, blanking out bits which Gyrge assumed showed that the landscape of Chark was orbital, not planetary. It annoyed him less than he'd have expected. He didn't enjoy the letter much. It all seemed so far away, so irrelevant. The ancient drone sounded hackneyed rather than wise or even friendly, and the people on the screen looked soft and stupid. Amalkne showed him Ikro, and Gyrge found himself angered at the fact that people came and stayed there every now and again. Who did they think they were? Ye Meristinu didn't appear in the letter. She'd finally grown fed up with Blask and the Preya Shipleil machine and left to pursue her landscaping career in... deleted. She sent her love. When she left, she'd started the viral change to become a man. There was one odd section right at the end of the communication, apparently added after the main signal had been recorded. Chamlis was shown in the main lounge at Ikro.
Gyrge, it said, this arrived today, general delivery, unspecified sender, care of special circumstances.
The view began to pan across to where, if no interfering interloper had changed the furniture around, there ought to have been a table. The screen blanked out.
Chamlis said, our little friend, but quite lifeless. I scanned it, and I had...
cut.
Send down its bugging team to take a look. It's dead. Just a casing with no mind, like an intact human body with a brain neatly scooped out. There's a small cavity in the centre where its mind must have been.
The visuals returned. The view panned round to Chamlis again.
I can only assume the thing finally agreed to be restructured, and they made it a new body. Ought they should send the old one here, though. Let me know what you want done with it. Write soon. Hope this finds you well and successful in whatever it is you're up to. Kind as
Gyrge switched the screen off. He got up quickly, went to the window, and looked out at the courtyard beneath, frowning. A smile spread slowly across his face. He laughed silently after a moment, then went over to the intercom and told his servant to bring some wine. He was just raising the glass to his lips when Fleer Imsaho floated in through the window, returning from another wildlife safari, its casing pale with dust.
You look pleased with yourself, it said. What's the toast?
Gyrge gazed into the wine's amber depths and smiled. Absent friends, he said, and drank. The next game was a three-game. Gyrge was to face Yomanol Lurasp, the Star Marshal imprisoned in the exoskeleton, and a youngish colonel, Lofrag Traff. He knew that, going on form, they were both supposed to be inferior to Kroo, but the intelligence chief had done so badly, he was unlikely to hold on to his post now. Gyrge didn't think this was any indication he was going to have an easier game against his next two opponents than he'd had against the last one. On the contrary, it would be only natural for the two military men to gang up on him. Nikosar was to play the old Star Marshal, Vecesida, and the Defence Minister, Gilno. Gyrge passed the day studying. Fleer Imsaho continued to explore. It told Gyrge it had watched a whole region of the advancing firefront being extinguished by a torrential rainstorm. It had revisited the area a couple of days later to find tinder plants reigniting the dried vegetation. As an example of how integral the fire and the rest of the planet's ecology had become, the drone said, it was an impressive display. The court amused itself with hunts in the forests during the daylight hours and live or hollow shows at night. Gergely found the entertainments predictable and tedious. The only faintly interesting ones were duels, usually males fighting each other, held in pits surrounded by banked circles of shouting, betting imperial officials and players. The duels were only occasionally to the death. Gergely suspected that things went on in the castle at night, entertainments of a different sort, which were inevitably fatal for at least one of the participants, and which he would not be welcome to attend or expected to hear about. However, the thought no longer worried him. Lofrag Traff was a young apex with a very obvious scar running from one brow down his cheek almost to his mouth. He played quick, fierce games, and his career in the Imperial Star Army bore the same hallmarks. His most famous exploit had been the sacking of the Urrutipeg Library. Traff had been in command of a small ground force in a war against a humanoid species. The war in space had been fought to a temporary stalemate, but through a combination of great military talent and a little luck, Traff found himself in a position to threaten the species' capital city from the ground. The enemy had sued for peace, making it a condition of the treaty that their great library, famous throughout the civilized species of the Lesser Cloud, be left untouched. Traff knew that if he refused this condition, the fight would go on, so he gave his word that not a letter, not a pixel on the ancient microfiles would be destroyed, and they would be left in situ. Traff had orders from his Star Marshal that the library had to be destroyed. Nikosar himself had commanded this as one of his first edicts after coming to power. Subject races had to understand that once they displeased the Emperor, nothing could prevent their punishment. While nobody in the Empire cared in the least about one of its loyal soldiers breaking an agreement with some bunch of aliens, Traff knew that giving your word was a sacred thing. Nobody would ever trust him again if he went back on it. Traff already knew what he was going to do. He solved the problem by shuffling the library, sorting every word in it into alphabetical order and every pixel of every illustration into order of color, shade, and intensity. The original microfiles were wiped and re-recorded with volumes upon volumes of these, its, and ands, and illustrations were fields of pure color. There were riots, of course, but Traff was in control by then, and as he explained to the incensed, and as it turned out literally, suicidal guardians of the library and to the Empire's Supreme Court, he had kept his word about not actually destroying or taking as booty a single word, image, or file. Halfway through the game on the Board of Origin, Gergely realized something remarkable. Yomanul and Traff were playing each other, not him. They played as if they expected him to win anyway and were battling for second place. Gergely had known there was little love lost between the two. Yomanul represented the old guard of the military and Traff the new wave of brash young adventurers. Yomanul was an exponent of negotiation and minimum force, Traff of the moves that smite. Yomanul had a liberal view of other species. Traff was a xenophobe. The two came from traditionally opposed colleges, and all their differences were displayed quite overtly in their game styles. Yomanul's was studied, careful, and detached. Traff's was aggressive to the point of recklessness. Their attitude to the Emperor was different, too. Yomanul took a cool, practical view of the throne, while Traff was utterly loyal to Nikosar himself, rather than the position he held. Each detested the beliefs of the other. Nevertheless, Gergely hadn't expected them to more or less disregard him and go straight for each other's throats. Once again, he felt slightly cheated that he wasn't getting a proper game. The only compensation was that the amount of venom in the play of the two warring military men was something to behold, undeniably impressive if distressingly self-defeating and wasteful. Gergely cruised through the game, quietly picking up points while the two soldiers fought. He was winning, but he couldn't help feeling the other two were getting much more out of the game than he was. He'd have expected they would use the physical option, but Nikosar himself had ordered that there be no betting during the match. He knew the two players were pathologically opposed, and didn't want to risk losing the military services of either. Gergely sat watching a table screen during lunch on his third day on the Board of Origin. There were still a few minutes before play resumed, and Gergely sat alone, watching the news reports showing how well Lotenios Kroa was doing in his game against Yomanul and Traff. Whoever had faked the Apex's play, not Kroa himself, who'd refused to have anything to do with the subterfuge, was making a good job of impersonating the intelligence chief's style. Gergely smiled a little.
"Contemplating your coming victory, Jana Gergay,"
Harmin said, easing himself into the seat across the table. Gergay turned the screen around.
"It's a little early for that, don't you think?"
The old, bald Apex peered at the screen, smiling thinly.
You think so?
He reached out, turned the screen off.
"Things change, Harmin." "Indeed they do, Gergay. But I think the course of this game will not. Yomanul and Traf will continue to ignore you and attack each other. You will win."
"Well then," Gergay said, looking at the dead screen, "Kroa will get to play Nikosar."
"Kroa may. We can devise a match to cover that. You must not."
"Must not?" Gergay said. "I thought I'd done all you wanted. What else can I do?"
"Refuse to play the Emperor."
Gergay looked into the old Apex's pale grey eyes, each set in a web of fine lines. They gazed just as calmly back.
"What's the problem, Harmin? I'm not a threat anymore."
Harmin smoothed the fine material at the cuff of his robe.
"You know, Jana Gergay, I do hate obsessions. They're so blinding, yes?"
He smiled.
"I am becoming worried for my Emperor, Gergay. I know how much he wants to prove he is rightfully on the throne, that he is worthy of the post he's held the last 2 years. I believe he will do just that, but I know that what he really wants, what he always did want, is to play Molsha and win. That, of course, isn't possible anymore. The Emperor is dead. Long live the Emperor. He rises from the flames. But I think he sees old Molsha in you, Jernau Gergay. And it is you he feels he must play, you he must beat, the alien, the man from the culture, the Morat player of games. I am not sure that would be a good idea. It is not necessary. You will lose anyway, I feel certain, but, as I say, obsessions disturb me. It would be best for all concerned if you let it be known as soon as possible you will retire after this game."
"And deprive Nikosar the chance to beat me?" Gergay looked surprised and amused.
"Yes. Better he still feels there's something still to prove. It will do him no harm."
"I'll think about it," Gergay said. Harmin studied him for a moment.
"I hope you understand how frank I've been with you, Jana Gergay. It would be unfortunate if such honesty went unacknowledged and unrewarded."
Gergay nodded.
"Yes, I don't doubt it would."
A male servant at the door announced the game was about to recommence.
"Excuse me, Rector," Gergay said, rising. The old Apex's eyes followed him.
"Duty calls."
"Obey," Harmin said.
Gergay stopped, looking down at the wizened old creature on the far side of the table. Then he turned and left. Harmin gazed at the blank table screen in front of him, as if absorbed in some fascinating, invisible game that only he could see. Gergay won on the board of origin and the board of form. The ferocious struggle between Traf and Yomanul continued, first one edged ahead, then the other. Traf went into the board of becoming with a very slight lead over the older Apex. Gergay was so far ahead he was almost invulnerable, able to relax in his strongholds and spectate upon the total war around him, heading out to mop up whatever was left of the exhausted victor's forces. It seemed the only fair, not to mention expedient, thing to do. Let the lads have their fun, then impose order later and tidy the toys back in the box. Still no substitute for a real game, though.
"Are you pleased or displeased, Mr. Gergay?"
Star Marshal Yomanul came up to Gergay and asked him the question during a pause in the game, while Traf consulted with the adjudicator on a point of order. Gergay had been standing thinking, staring at the board, and hadn't noticed the imprisoned Apex approach. He looked up in surprise to see the Star Marshal in front of him, his lined face looking out, faintly amused from its titanium and carbon cage. Neither soldier had paid him any attention until now.
"At being left out," Gergay said.
The Apex moved one rod-braced arm to indicate the board.
"Yes, to be winning so easily. Do you seek the victory or the challenge?"
The Apex's skeletal mask moved with each action of the jaw.
"I'd prefer both," Gergay admitted. "I have thought of joining in as a third force, or on one side or the other, but this looks too much like a personal war.
The elderly Apex grinned. The headcage nodded easily.
It is, he said. You're doing very well as you are. I wouldn't change now if I were you.
What about you? Gergay asked. You seem to be getting the worst of it at the moment. Yominal smiled. The face mask flexed even for that small gesture.
I'm having the time of my life, and I still have a few surprises lined up for the youngster, and a few tricks. But I feel a little guilty letting you through so easily. You'll embarrass us all if you play Nikosar and win.
Gergay expressed surprise. You think I could?
No.
The Apex's gesture was the more emphatic for being contained and amplified in its dark cage.
Nikosar plays at his best when he has to, and at his best he will beat you, so long as he isn't too ambitious. No, he'll beat you because you'll threaten him and he will respect that, but ah!
The Star Marshal turned as Traff strode across the board, moved a couple of pieces, and then bowed with exaggerated courtesy to Yominal. The Star Marshal looked back at Gergay.
I see it is my turn. Excuse me.
He returned to the fray. Perhaps one of the tricks Yominal had mentioned was making Traff think his conversation with Gergay had been to enlist the Culture Man's aid. For some time afterward, the younger soldier acted as though he was expecting to have to fight on two fronts. It gave Yominal an edge. He scraped in ahead of Traff. Gergay won the match and the chance to play Nikosar. Harmin tried to talk to him in the corridor outside the game hall immediately after his victory, but Gergay just smiled and walked past. Cinderbuds swayed all around them. The light wind made shushing noises in the golden canopy. The court, the game players and their retinues, sat on a high, steeply raked wooden structure, itself almost the size of a small castle. Before the stand, in a large clearing in the Cinderbud forest, was a long, narrow run, a double fence of stout timbers 5 meters or more high. This formed the central section of a sort of open corral, shaped like an hourglass and open to the forest at both ends. Nikosar and the higher-placed players sat at the front of the high wooden platform with a good view of the wooden funnel. At the back of the stand, there were awninged areas where food was being prepared. Smells of roasting meat drifted over the stand and out into the forest.
That'll have them frothing at the mouth, Star Marshal Yominal said, leaning over to Gergay with a whirring of servos.
They were sitting side by side on the front rank of the platform, a little along from the Emperor. Both held a large projectile rifle, fastened to a supporting tripod in front of them. What will? Gergay asked.
The smell.
Yominal grinned, gesturing behind them to the fires and grills.
Roasted meat. Wind's carrying it their way. It'll drive them crazy.
Oh, great,
muttered Flea Emsaho from near Gergay's feet. It had already tried to persuade Gergay not to take part in the hunt. Gergay ignored the machine and nodded.
Of course, he said.
He hefted the rifle stock. The ancient weapon was single-shot. A sliding bolt had to be operated to reload it. Each gun had slightly different rifling patterns, so that when the bullets were removed from the bodies of the animals, the marks on them would allow a score to be kept, and heads and pelts to be allocated.
You sure you've used one of these before?
Yominal asked, grinning at him. The Apex was in a good mood. In a few tens of days, he would be released from the exoskeleton. Meanwhile, the Emperor had allowed the prison regimen to be relaxed. Yominal could socialize, drink, and eat whatever he liked. Gergay nodded.
I've shot guns, he said.
He'd never used a projectile gun, but there had been that day, years ago now, with Ye in the desert.
Bet you've never shot anything live before, the drone said.
Yominal tapped the machine's casing with one carbon-shod foot.
Quiet thing, he said.
Flea Imsaho tipped slowly up so that its beveled brown front pointed up at Gergay.
Thing,
it said indignantly in a sort of whispered screech. Gergay winked and put his finger to his lips. He and Yominal grinned at each other. The hunt, as it was called, started with a blare of trumpets and the distant howling of the Troche. A line of males appeared from the forest and ran alongside the wooden funnel, beating the timbers with rods. The first Troche appeared, shadows striping along its flanks as it entered the clearing and ran into the wooden funnel. The people around Gergay murmured in anticipation.
A big one!
Yominal said appreciatively, as the golden-black striped beast loped six-legged down the run. Clicks all around the platform announced people preparing to fire. Gergay lifted the stock of the rifle. Fastened to its tripod, the rifle was easier to handle in the harsh gravity than it would have been otherwise, as well as being limited in its field of fire, something the Emperor's ever-watchful guards no doubt found reassuring. The Trochet sprinted down the run, paws blurring on the dusty ground. People fired at it, filling the air with muffled cracking noises and puffs of grey smoke. White wood splinters spun off the run's timbers, puffs of dust burst from the ground. Yominor sighted and fired. A chorus of shots burst out around Gergé. The guns were silenced, but all the same, Gergé felt his ears close up a little, deadening the racket. He fired. The recoil took him by surprise. His bullet must have gone way over the animal's head. He looked down into the run. The animal was screaming. It tried to leap up the fence on the far side of the run, but was brought down in a hail of fire. It limped on a little further, dragging three legs and leaving a trail of blood behind it. Gergé heard another muffled report by his side, and the carnivore's head jerked suddenly to one side. It collapsed. A great cheer went up. A gate in the run was opened, and some males scurried in to drag the body away. Yominal was on his feet beside Gergé, acknowledging the cheers. He sat down again quickly, exoskeleton motors whirring, as the next animal appeared out of the forest and raced between the wooden walls. After the fourth Trochet, several came at once, and in the confusion one scrambled up the timbers of the run and over the top. It started to chase some of the males waiting outside the run. A guard, on the ground at the foot of the stand, brought the animal down with a single laser shot. In the mid-morning, when a great pile of the striped bodies had accumulated in the middle of the run, and there was a danger some animals would climb out over the bodies of their predecessors, the hunt was stopped while males used hooks and hawsers and a couple of small tractors to clear the warm, blood-spattered debris. Somebody on the far side of the Emperor shot one of the males while they were working. There were some tuts and a few drunken cheers. The Emperor fined the offender and told them if they did it again, they'd find themselves running with a Trochet. Everybody laughed.
"You're not firing, Gergé," Yominor said.
He reckoned he'd killed another three animals by then. Gergé had begun to find the hunt a little pointless, and almost stopped firing. He kept missing anyway.
"I'm not very good at this," he said.
"Practice!"
Yominor laughed, slapping him on the back. The servo-amplified blow from the elated Star Marshal almost knocked the wind out of Gergé. Yominor claimed another kill. He gave an excited shout and kicked Flea Imsaho.
"Fetch!"
he laughed. The drone rose slowly and with dignity from the floor.
"Do you know, Gergé," it said, "I'm not putting up with any more of this. I'm going back to the castle. Do you mind?"
"Not at all."
"Thank you. Enjoy your marksmanship."
It floated down and to the side, disappearing round the edge of the stand. Yominal had it in his sights most of the way.
"You just let it go?"
he asked Gergé, laughing.
"Glad to be rid of it," Gergé told him.
They broke for lunch. Nikosar congratulated Yominal, saying how well he'd shot. Gergé sat with Yominal at lunch too, and went down on one knee as Nikosar's palanquin was brought up to their part of the table. Yominal told the Emperor the exoskeleton helped steady his aim. Nikosar said it was the Emperor's pleasure that the device be removed soon, after the formal end of the games. Nikosar glanced at Gergé, but said nothing else. The AG palanquin lifted itself, the Imperial Guards nudged it further down the line of waiting people. After lunch, people returned to their seats, and the hunt went on. There were other animals to hunt, and the first part of the short afternoon was spent shooting them. But the Trochet came back later on. So far, only 7 of the 200 or so Trochet released from the forest pens into the run had made it all the way through the wooden funnel and out the far end to escape into the forest. Even they were wounded, and would anyway be caught by the incandescents. The earth in the wooden funnel in front of the shooting platform was dark with auburn blood. Gergé shot as the animals pounded down the sodden run, but aimed to just miss them, watching for the spatter of muddy ground in front of their noses as they tore, wounded and howling and panting, in front of him. He found the whole hunt somewhat distasteful, but could not deny that the infectious excitement of the Azadians had some effect on him. Yominal was obviously enjoying himself. The Apex leaned over as a large female Trochet came running out of the forest with two small cubs.
"You'll need more practice, Gergé," he said. "Don't you do any hunting at home?"
The female and her cubs ran toward the wooden funnel.
"Not much," Gergé admitted.
Yominal grunted, aimed at long range, and fired. One of the cubs dropped. The female skidded, stopped, went back to it. The other cub ran on hesitantly. It mewled as bullets hit it. Yominal reloaded.
"I was surprised to see you here at all," he said.
The female, stung by a bullet in a rear leg, swung growling away from the dead cub and charged forward again, roaring at the tottering wounded cub.
"I wanted to show I wasn't squeamish," Gergay said,
watching the second cub's head jerk up and the beast fall at the feet of its mother.
"And I have hunted."
He was going to use the word Azad, which meant machine and animal, any organism or system, and he turned to Yominal with a small smile to say this, but when he looked at the apex, he could see there was something wrong. Yominal was shaking. He sat, clutching his gun, turned half toward Gergay, face quivering in its dark cage, skin white and covered in sweat, eyes bulging. Gergay went to put his hand on the strut of the Star Marshal's forearm, instinctively offering support. It was as though something broke inside the apex. Yominal's gun swung right round, snapping the supporting tripod. The bulky silencer pointed straight at Gergay's forehead. Gergay had a fleeting, vivid impression of Yominal's face, jaw clamped shut, blood trickling over his chin, eyes staring, a tick working furiously on the side of his face. Gergay ducked. The gun fired somewhere over his head, and he heard a scream as he fell out of his seat, rolling past his own gun's tripod. Before he could get up, Gergay was kicked in the back. He turned over to see Yominal above him, swaying crazily against the background of shocked, pale faces behind him. He was struggling with the rifle bolt, reloading. One foot lashed out again, thudding into Gergay's ribs. He jerked back, trying to absorb the blow, and fell over the front of the platform. He saw wooden slats whirling, cinderbuds revolving, then he struck, crashing into a male animal handler standing just before the run. They each thudded to the ground, winded. Gergay looked up and saw Yominal on the platform, exoskeleton glinting dully in the sunlight, raising the rifle and sighting on him. Two apices came up behind Yominal, arms out to grasp him. Without even glancing back, Yominal swung his arms, flashing round behind him. A hand smashed into the chest of one apex. The rifle slammed into the face of the other. Both collapsed. The carbon-ribbed arms darted back, and Yominal steadied the gun again, aiming at Gergay. Gergay was on his feet, diving away. The shot hit the still-winded male lying behind him. Gergay stumbled for the wooden doors leading under the high platform. Shouts came from the platform as Yominal jumped down, landing between Gergay and the doors. The Star Marshal reloaded the gun as he hit the ground on his feet, the exoskeleton easily absorbing the shock of landing. Gergay almost fell as he turned, feet skidding on the blood-spattered earth. He pushed himself off the ground to run between the edge of the wooden fence and the platform edge. A uniformed guard with a crew rifle stood in his way, looking uncertainly up at the platform. Gergay went to run past him, ducking as he did so. Still a few meters in front of Gergay, the guard started to put one hand out and unhitch the laser from his shoulder. A look of almost comic surprise appeared on his flat face, an instant before one side of his chest burst open and he spun round into Gergay's path, knocking him over. Gergay rolled again, clattering over the dead guard. He sat up. Yominal was 10 meters away, running awkwardly toward him, reloading. The guard's rifle was at Gergay's feet. He reached out, grabbed it, aimed at Yominal and fired. The Star Marshal ducked, but Gergay was still allowing for recoil after a morning shooting the projectile rifle. The laser shot slammed into Yominal's face. The apex's head blew apart. Yominal didn't stop. He didn't even slow down. The running figure, head cage almost empty, trailing strips of flesh and splintered bone behind it like penance, neck spouting blood, speeded up. It ran faster toward him, and less awkwardly. It aimed the rifle straight at Gergay's head. Gergay froze, stunned. Too late, he started to sight the crew gun again and began struggling to get up. The headless exoskeleton was 3 meters away. He stared into the silencer's black mouth, and he knew he was dead. But the bizarre figure hesitated, empty headshell jerking upward, and the gun wavered. Something crashed into Gergay. From the back, he realized, surprised, as everything went dark. From the back, not from the front. And then came nothing. His back hurt. He opened his eyes. A bulky brown drone hummed between him and a white ceiling. "Gergay?" the machine said. He swallowed, licked his lips. "What?" he said. He didn't know where he was, or who the drone was. He had only a very vague idea who he was.
"Gurge, it's me, Fleer Imsaho. How do you feel?"
Fleer Imsaho. The name meant something. "Back hurts a bit," he said, hoping not to be found out. "Gurge, Gurge?" Must be his name.
"I'm not surprised. A very large troche hit you in the back."
"A what?"
"Never mind. Go back to sleep."
Sleep. His eyelids felt very heavy, and the drone looked blurred. His back hurt. He opened his eyes and saw a white ceiling. He looked around for Fleer Imsaho. Dark wooden walls. Window. Fleer Imsaho. There it was. It floated over to him.
"Hello, Gurge."
"Hello."
"Do you remember who I am?"
"Still asking stupid questions, Fleer Imsaho. Am I going to be all right?"
"You're bruised. You've got a cracked rib, and you're mildly concussed. You ought to be able to get up in a day or two."
"Do I remember you saying a troche hit me? Did I dream that?"
"You didn't dream it. I did tell you. That's what happened." "How much do you remember?"
"Falling off the stand, platform," he said slowly, trying to think. He was in bed and his back was sore. It was his own room in the castle, and the lights were on, so it was probably night. His eyes widened. "Yomanul kicked me off," he said suddenly.
"Why?" "It doesn't matter now. Go back to sleep."
Gurge started to say something else, but he felt tired again as the drone buzzed closer, and he closed his eyes for a second, just to rest them. Gurge stood by the window looking down into the courtyard. The male servant took the tray out, glasses clinking. "Go on," he said to the drone.
"The troche climbed the fence while everybody was watching you and Yomanul. It came up behind you and sprang. It hit you and then bowled over the exoskeleton before it had time to do much about it. Guards shot the troche as it tried to gore Yomanul, and by the time they dragged it off the exoskeleton, it had deactivated."
Gurge shook his head slowly. "All I remember is being kicked off the stand." He sat down in a chair by the window. The far edge of the courtyard was golden in the hazy light of late afternoon. "And where were you while this was happening?"
"Back here, watching the hunt on an Imperial broadcast. I'm sorry I left, Jurna Gurge, but that appalling apex was kicking me, and the whole obscene spectacle was just too gory and disgusting for words."
Gurge waved one hand. "It doesn't matter, I'm alive." He put his face in his hands. "You sure it was I who shot Yomanul?"
"Oh, yes. It's all recorded. Do you want—"
"No." Gurge held up one hand to the drone, eyes still closed. "No, I don't want to watch."
"I didn't see that bit live," Fleer Imsaho said. "I was on my way back to the hunt as soon as Yomanul fired his first shot and killed the person on the other side of you. But I've watched the recording. Yes, you killed him, with the guard's crew. But of course, that just meant whoever had taken control of the exoskeleton didn't have to fight against Yomanul inside it. As soon as Yomanul was dead, the thing moved a lot faster and less erratically. He must have been using all his strength to try and stop it."
Gurge stared at the floor. "You're certain about all this?"
"Absolutely."
The drone drifted over to the wall screen.
"Look, why not watch it on your—"
"No!" Gurge shouted, standing and then swaying. He sat down again. "No," he said quieter.
"By the time I got there, whoever was jamming the exoskeleton controls had gone. I got a brief reading on my microwave sensors while I was between here and the hunt, but it switched off before I could get an accurate fix. Some kind of phased pulse maser. The Imperial guards picked up something too. They'd started a search in the forest by the time we took you away. I persuaded them I knew what I was doing and had you brought here. They sent a doctor in to look at you a couple of times, but that's all. Lucky I got there when I did, or they might have taken you to the infirmary and started doing all sorts of nasty tests on you." The drone sounded perplexed. "That's why I have a feeling this wasn't a straight security service job. They'd have tried other, less public ways to kill you, and they'd have been all set up to get you into the hospital if it hadn't quite worked. All too disorganized. There's something funny going on, I'm sure."
Gurge put his hands to his back, carefully tracing the extent of the bruising again, I wish I could remember everything. I wish I could remember whether I meant to kill Yamanul, he said. His chest ached. He felt sick.
As you did, and you're such a bad shot, I'd assume the answer is no.
Gergay looked at the machine. Don't you have something else you could be doing, drone?
Not really. Oh, by the way, the Emperor wants to see you, when you're feeling well.
I'll go now, Gergay said, standing slowly.
Are you sure? I don't think you should. You don't look well. I'd lie down if I were you. Please sit down. You're not ready. What if he's angry because you killed Yamanul? Oh, I suppose I'd better come with you.
Nikosar sat in a small throne in front of a great bank of slanting multicolored windows. The imperial apartments were submerged in the deep polychromatic light. Huge wall tapestries sewn with precious metal threads glittered like treasures in an underwater cave. Guards stood impassively around the walls and behind the throne. Courtiers and officials shuffled to and fro with papers and flat screens. An officer of the imperial household brought Gergay to the throne, leaving Fleer Emsaho at the other end of the room under the watchful eyes of two guards.
Please sit.
Nikosar motioned Gergay to a small stool on the dais in front of him. Gergay sat down gratefully.
Janao Gergay, the Emperor said,
his voice quiet and controlled, almost flat.
We offer you our sincere apologies for what happened yesterday. We are glad to see you have made such a rapid recovery, though we understand you are still in pain. Is there anything you wish? Thank you, Your Highness, no.
We are glad.
Nikosar nodded slowly. He was still dressed in unrelieved black. His sober dress, small frame and plain face, contrasted with the fabulous splashes of colour from the raked windows overhead and the sumptuous clothing of the courtiers. The Emperor put small ringed hands on the arms of the throne.
We are, of course, deeply sorry to lose the regard and the services of our Star Marshal, Yamanul Lurasp, especially in such tragic circumstances. But we understand that you had no choice but to defend yourself. It is our will that no action be taken against you.
Thank you, Your Highness.
Nikosar waved one hand. In the matter of who plotted against you, the person who took control of our Star Marshal's imprisoning device was discovered and put to the question.
We were deeply hurt to discover that the leading conspirator was our long-life mentor and guide, the rector of Kantsev College.
Harm, Gergay began, but stopped.
Nikosar's face was a study in displeasure. The old Apex's name died in Gergay's throat. Gergay started again. Nikosar held up one hand.
We wish to tell you that the rector of Kantsev College, Harmen Le Srelist, has been sentenced to death for his part in the conspiracy against you. We understand that this may not have been the only attempt on your life. If this is so, then all relevant circumstances will be investigated and the wrongdoers brought to justice.
Certain persons in the court, Nikosar said, looking at the rings on his hands, have desired to protect their emperor through misguided actions. The Emperor needs no such protection from a game opponent, even if that opponent uses aids we deny ourselves. It has been necessary to deceive our subjects in the matter of your progress in these final games, but this is for their good, not ours. We have no need to be protected from unpleasant truths. The Emperor knows no fear, only discretion. We shall be happy to postpone the game between the Emperor Regent and the man Jurnau Morat Gergay until he feels fit to play.
Gergay found himself waiting for more of the quiet, slow, half-sung words, but Nikosar sat impassively silent.
I thank Your Highness, Gergay said, but I would prefer there be no postponement. I feel almost well enough to play now, and there are still 3 days before the match is due to start. I'm sure there is no need to delay further.
Nikosar nodded slowly.
We are pleased. We hope, though, that if Jurnau Gergay desires to change his mind on this matter before the match is due to start, he will not hesitate to inform the Imperial Office, which will gladly put back the starting date of the final match until Jurnau Gergay feels fit to play the game of Azad to the very best of his ability.
I thank Your Highness again.
We are pleased that Jurnau Gergay was not badly injured and has been able to attend this audience, Nikosar said.
He nodded briefly to Gergay, and then looked to a courtier, waiting impatiently to one side. Gergay stood,
bowed, and backed away.
"You only have to take 4 backward steps before you turn your back on him,"
Fleer Imsaho told him. "Otherwise, very good." They were back in Gerge's room.
"I'll try and remember next time," he said.
"Anyway, sounds like you're in the clear. I did a bit of overhearing while you had your tete-a-tete. Courtiers usually know what's going on. Seems they found an apex trying to escape through the forest from the Mesa and the exo-controls. He dropped the gun they gave him to defend himself with, which was just as well, because it was a bomb, not a gun, so they got him alive. He broke under torture, and implicated one of Hamin's cronies, who tried to bargain with a confession. So they started on Hamin."
"You mean they tortured him?"
"Only a little. He's old, and they had to keep him alive for whatever punishment the Emperor decided on. The Apex exocontroller and some other henchmen have been impaled, the plea-bargaining cronies getting caged in the forest to await the incandescence, and Harmon's being deprived of AGE drugs. He'll be dead in 40 or 50 days.
Gerge shook his head.
"Hamin? I didn't think he was that frightened of me."
"Well, he's old. They have funny ideas sometimes."
"Do you think I'm safe now?"
"Yes. The Emperor wants you alive so he can destroy you on the Azad boards. Nobody else would dare harm you. You can concentrate on the game. Anyway, I'll look after you."
Gerge looked disbelievingly at the buzzing drone. He could detect no trace of irony in its voice. Gerge and Nikosar started the first of the lesser games 3 days later. There was a curious atmosphere about the final match. A sense of anti-climax pervaded Castle Clough. Normally the last contest was the culmination of 6 years' work and preparation in the Empire, the very apotheosis of all that Azad was and stood for. This time, the Imperial continuance was already settled. Nikosar had ensured his next great year of rule when he'd beaten Vecesteda and Jilno, though as far as the rest of the Empire knew, the Emperor still had to play Kroo to decide who wore the Imperial crown. Even if Gerge did win the game, it would make no difference, save for some wounded Imperial pride. The court and the bureau would put it down to experience and make sure they didn't invite any more decadent but sneaky aliens to take part in the holy game. Gerge suspected that many of the people still in the fortress would as soon have left Ikronadal to head back to Ir, but the coronation ceremony and the religious confirmation still had to be witnessed, and nobody would be allowed to leave Ikronadal until the fire had passed and the Emperor had risen from its embers. Probably only Gerge and Nikosar were really looking forward to the match. Even the observing game players and analysts were disheartened at the prospect of witnessing a game they were already barred from discussing, even among themselves. All Gerge's games past the point he'd supposedly been knocked out were taboo subjects. They did not exist. The Imperial Games Bureau was already hard at work concocting an official final match between Nikosar and Kroo. Judging by their previous efforts, Gerge expected it to be entirely convincing. It might lack the ultimate spark of genius, but it would pass. So, everything was already settled. The Empire had new Star Marshals, though a little shuffling would be required to replace Yominal. New generals and admirals, archbishops, ministers and judges. The course of the Empire was set, and with very little change from the previous bearing. Nikosar would continue with his present policies. The premises of the various winners indicated little discontent or new thinking. The courtiers and officials could therefore breathe easily again, knowing nothing would alter too much, and their positions were as secure as they'd ever be. So, instead of the usual tension surrounding the final game, there was an atmosphere more like that of an exhibition match. Only the two contestants were treating it as a real contest. Gerge was immediately impressed by Nikosar's play. The Emperor didn't stop rising in Gerge's estimation. The more he studied the Apex's play, the more he realized just how powerful and complete an opponent he was facing. He would need to be more than lucky to beat Nikosar. He would need to be somebody else. From the beginning, he tried to concentrate on not being trounced rather than actually defeating the Emperor. Nikosar played cautiously most of the time. Then, suddenly, he'd strike out with some brilliant flowing series of moves that looked at first as though they'd been made by some gifted madman, before revealing themselves as the masterstrokes they were. Perfect answers to the impossible questions they themselves posed. Gerge did his best to anticipate these devastating fusions of guile and power, and to find replies to them once they'd begun. But by the time the minor games were over, 30 days or so before the fire was due, Nikosar had a considerable advantage in pieces and cards to carry over to the first of the three great boards. Gurge suspected his only chance was to hold out as best he could on the first two boards and hope that he might pull something back on the final one. The cinderbuds towered around the castle, rising like a slow tide of gold about the walls. Gurge sat in the same small garden he'd visited before. Then he'd been able to look out over the cinderbuds to the distant horizon. Now the view ended 20 meters away at the first of the great yellow leaf heads. Late sunlight spread the castle's shadow across the canopy. Behind Gurge, the fortress lights were coming on. Gurge looked out to the tan trunks of the great trees and shook his head. He'd lost the game on the board of origin, and now he was losing on the board of form. He was missing something. Some facet of the way Nikosar was playing was escaping him. He knew it. He was certain. But he couldn't work out what that facet was. He had a nagging suspicion it was something very simple, however complex its articulation on the boards might be. He ought to have spotted it, analyzed and evaluated it long ago, and turned it to his advantage, but for some reason intrinsic to his very understanding of the game, he felt sure, he could not. An aspect of his play seemed to have disappeared, and he was starting to think the knock to the head he'd taken during the hunt had affected him more than he'd first assumed. But then, the ship didn't seem to have any better idea what he was doing wrong, either. Its advice always seemed to make sense at the time, but when Gurge got to the board, he found he could never apply the ship's ideas. If he went against his instincts and forced himself to do as the limiting factor had suggested, he ended up in even more trouble. Nothing was more guaranteed to cause you problems on an Azad board than trying to play in a way you didn't really believe in. He rose slowly, straightening his back, which was hardly sore now, and returned to his room. Fleer Imseho was in front of the screen, watching a hollow display of an odd diagram. "What are you doing?" Gurge said, lowering himself into a soft chair. The drone turned, addressing him in Meran.
"I worked out a way to disable the bugs. We can talk in Meran now. Isn't that good?"
"I suppose so," Gurge said, still in the Yatchik. He picked up a small flat screen to see what was happening in the Empire.
"Well, you might at least use the language after I went to the trouble of jamming their bugs. It wasn't easy, you know. I'm not designed for that sort of thing. I had to learn a lot of stuff from some of my own files about electronics and optics and listening fields and all that sort of technical stuff. I thought you'd be pleased."
"Utterly and profoundly ecstatic," Gurge said carefully, in Meran. He looked at the small screen. It told him of the new appointments, the crushing of an insurrection in a distant system, the progress of the game between Nikosar and Kroo. Kroo wasn't as far behind as Gurge was. The victory won by Imperial troops against a race of monsters, and higher rates of pay for males who volunteered to join the army. "What is that you're looking at?" he said, looking briefly at the wall screen, where Fleer Imseho's strange torus turned slowly.
"Don't you recognize it?"
the drone said, voice pitched to express surprise.
"I thought you would. It's a model of the reality.
The... oh, yes." Gurge nodded and went back to the small screen where a group of asteroids was being bombarded by Imperial battleships to quell the insurrection. "Four dimensions and all that." He flicked through the subchannels to the game programs. A few of the second series matches were still being played on ear.
"Well, seven relevant dimensions, actually, in the case of the reality itself. One of those lines... are you listening?"
"Hmm? Oh, yes." The games on ear were all in their last stages. The secondary games from Ikronidal were still being analyzed.
"One of those lines on the reality represents our entire universe. Surely you were taught all this?"
"Hmm," Gurge nodded. He had never been especially interested in spatial theory or hyperspace or hyperspheres or the like. None of it seemed to make any difference to how he lived, so what did it matter? There were some games that were best understood in four dimensions, but Gurge only cared about their own particular rules, and the general theories only meant anything to him as they applied specifically to those games. He pressed for another page on the small screen, to be confronted with a picture of himself, once more expressing his sadness at being knocked out of the games, wishing the people and Empire of Azad well, and thanking everybody for having him. An announcer talked over his faded voice to say that Gurge had pulled out of the second series games on Ikronidal. Gurge smiled thinly, watching the official reality he'd agreed to be part of as it gradually built up and became accepted fact. He looked up briefly at the Taurus on the screen and remembered something he'd puzzled over years ago now. "What's the difference between a hyperspace and ultraspace?" he asked the drone. "The ship mentioned ultraspace once, and I never could work out what the hell it was talking about." The drone tried to explain, using the hollow model of the reality to illustrate. As ever, it over-explained, but Gergé got the idea, for what it was worth. Fleer Imsaho annoyed him that evening, chattering away in Marain all the time about anything and everything. After initially finding it rather needlessly complex, Gergé enjoyed hearing the language again, and discovered some pleasure in speaking it, but the drone's high, squeaky voice became tiring after a while. It only shut up while he had his customary rather negative and depressing game analysis with the ship that evening, still in Marain. He had his best night's sleep since the day of the hunt, and woke feeling, for no good reason he could think of, that there might yet be a chance of turning the game around. It took Gergé most of the morning's play to gradually work out what Nikosar was up to. When eventually he did, it took his breath away. The Emperor had set out to beat not just Gergé, but the whole culture. There was no other way to describe his use of pieces, territory and cards. He had set up his whole side of the match as an empire, the very image of Azad. Another revelation struck Gergé with a force almost as great. One reading, perhaps the best, of the way he'd always played was that he played as the culture. He'd habitually set up something like the society itself when he constructed his positions and deployed his pieces. A net, a grid of forces and relationships without any obvious hierarchy or entrenched leadership, and initially quite profoundly peaceful. In all the games he'd played, the fight had always come to Gergé initially. He'd thought of the period before as preparing for battle. But now he saw that if he'd been alone on the board, he'd have done roughly the same, spreading slowly across the territories, consolidating gradually, calmly, economically. Oh, of course, it had never happened. He always was attacked, and once the battle was joined, he developed that conflict as assiduously and totally as before he'd tried to develop the patterns and potential of unthreatened pieces and undisputed territory. Every other player he competed against had unwittingly tried to adjust to this novel style in its own terms and comprehensively failed. Nikosar was trying no such thing. He'd gone the other way and made the board his empire, complete and exact in every structural detail to the limits of definition the game's scale imposed. It stunned Gergé. The realization burst on him like some slow sunrise turning nova, like a trickle of understanding becoming stream, river, tide, tsunami. His next few moves were automatic, reaction moves, not properly thought out parts of his strategy, limited and inadequate though it had been shown to be. His mouth had gone dry. His hands shook. Of course. This was what he'd been missing. This was the hidden facet. So open and blatant, and there for all to see, it was effectively invisible. Too obvious for words or understanding. It was so simple, so elegant, so staggeringly ambitious, but so fundamentally practical, and so much what Nikosar obviously thought the whole game to be about. No wonder he'd been so desperate to play this man from the culture, if this was what he'd planned all along. Even the details Nikosar and only a handful of others in the Empire knew about the culture and its true size and scope were there, included and displayed on the board, but probably utterly indecipherable to those who did not already know. The style of Nikosar's board empire was of a complete thing fully shown. The assumptions about his opponent's forces were couched in terms of fractions of something greater. There was, too, a ruthlessness about the way the Emperor treated his own and his opponent's pieces which Gergé thought was almost a taunt, a tactic designed to disturb him. The Emperor sent pieces to their destruction with a sort of joyous callousness where Gergé would have hung back, attempting to prepare and build up. Where Gergé would have accepted surrender and conversion, Nikosar laid waste. The difference was slight in some ways. No good player simply squandered pieces or massacred purely for the sake of it, but the implication of applied brutality was there, like a flavour, like a stench, like a silent mist hanging over the board. He saw then that he'd been fighting back much as Nikasar might have expected him to, trying to save pieces, to make reasonable, considered conservative moves and, in a sense, to ignore the way Nikasar was kicking and slinging his pieces into battle and tearing strips of territory from his opponent like ribbons of tattered flesh. In a way, Gürge had been trying desperately not to play Nikasar. The Emperor was playing a rough, harsh, dictatorial, and frequently inelegant game, and had rightly assumed something in the culture man would simply not want to be a part of it. Gürge started to take stock, sizing up the possibilities while he played a few more inconsequential blocking moves to give himself time to think. The point of the game was to win. He'd been forgetting that. Nothing else mattered. Nothing else hung on the outcome of the game either. The game was irrelevant. Therefore, it could be allowed to mean everything, and the only barrier he had to negotiate was that put up by his own feelings. He had to reply. But how? Become the culture? Another empire? He was already playing the part of the culture, and it wasn't working. And how do you match an emperor as an imperialist? He stood there on the board, wearing his faintly ridiculous gathered-up clothes, and was only distantly aware of everything else around him. He tried to tear his thoughts away from the game for a moment, looking round the great ribbed prow hall of the castle, at the tall open windows and the yellow cinderbud canopy outside, at the half-full banks of seats, at the imperial guards and the adjudicating officials, at the great black horn shapes of the electronic screening equipment directly overhead, at the many people in their various clothes and guises, all translated into game thought, all viewed as though through some powerful drug which distorted everything he saw into twisted analogues of its latching hold on his brain. He thought of mirrors and of reverser fields, which gave the more technically artificial but perceivably more real impression. Mirror writing was what it said. Reversed writing was ordinary writing. He saw the closed torus of Fleer Imsahoe's unreal reality, remembered Chamlis Amalkne and its warning about deviousness, things which meant nothing and something, harmonics of his thought. Click. Switch off. Switch on. As though he was a machine. Fall off the edge of the catastrophe curve and never mind. He forgot everything and made the first move he saw. He looked at the move he'd made. Nothing like what Nikasar would have done. An archetypally culture move. He felt his heart sink. He'd been hoping for something different, something better. He looked again. Well, it was a culture move, but at least it was an attacking culture move. Followed through, it would wreck his whole cautious strategy so far, but it was all he could do if he was to have even the glimmer of a chance of resisting Nikasar. Pretend there really was a lot at stake. Pretend he was fighting for the whole culture. Set out to win, regardless, no matter. At least he'd found a way to play. Finally. He knew he was going to lose, but it would not be a rout. He gradually remodeled his whole game plan to reflect the ethos of the culture militant, trashing and abandoning whole areas of the board where the switch would not work, pulling back and regrouping and restructuring where it would, sacrificing where necessary, raising and scorching the ground where he had to. He didn't try to mimic Nikosar's crude but devastating attack, escape, return, invade strategy, but made his positions and his pieces in the image of a power that could eventually cope with such bludgeoning, if not now, then later when it was ready. He began to win a few points at last. The game was still lost, but there was still the board of becoming, where at last he might give Nikasar a fight. Once or twice he caught a certain look on Nikasar's face, when he was close enough to read the apex's expression, that convinced him he'd done the right thing, even if it was something the Emperor had somehow expected. There was a recognition there now, in the apex's expression and on the board, and even a kind of respect in those moves, an acknowledgement that they were fighting on even terms. Gürge was overcome by the sensation that he was like a wire with some terrible energy streaming through him. He was a great cloud, poised to strike lightning over the board, a colossal wave tearing across the ocean toward the sleeping shore, a great pulse of molten energy from a planetary heart, a god with the power to destroy and create at will. He had lost control of his own drug glands. The mix of chemicals in his bloodstream had taken over, and his brain felt saturated with the one encompassing idea like a fever. Win. Dominate. Control. A set of angles defining one desire, the single, absolute determination. The breaks and the times when he slept were irrelevant, just the intervals between the real life of the board and the game. He functioned, talking to the drone or the ship or other people, eating and sleeping and walking around, but it was all nothing, irrelevant. Everything outside was just a setting and a background for the game. He watched the rival forces surge and tide across the great board, and they spoke a strange language, sang a strange song that was at once a perfect set of harmonies and a battle to control the writing of the themes. What he saw in front of him was like a single huge organism. The pieces seemed to move as though with a will that was neither his nor the Emperor's, but something dictated finally by the game itself, an ultimate expression of its essence. He saw it. He knew Nikasar saw it. But he doubted anybody else could. They were like a pair of secret lovers, secure and safe in their huge nest of a room, locked together before hundreds of people who looked on and who saw, but who could not read and who would never guess what it was they were witnessing. The game on the board of form came to an end. Gergely lost, but he had pulled back from the brink, and the advantage Nikasar would take to the board of becoming was far from decisive. The two opponents separated. That act over, the final one yet to commence. Gergely left the prow hall exhausted and drained and gloriously happy, and slept for 2 days. The drone woke him.
Gergely, are you awake? Have you stopped being vague?
What are you talking about?
You. The game. What's going on? Even the ship couldn't work out what was happening on that board.
The drone floated above him, brown and grey, humming quietly. Gergely rubbed his eyes, blinked. It was morning. There were about 10 days to go before the fire was due. Gergely felt as though he was waking from a dream more vivid and real than reality. He yawned, sitting up.
Have I been vague?
Does pain hurt? Is a supernova bright?
Gergely stretched, smirking. Nikasar's taking it impersonally, he said, getting up and padding to the window. He stepped out onto the balcony. Fleer Imseho tutted and threw a robe around him.
If you're going to start talking in riddles again, what riddles?
Gergely drank in the mild air. He flexed his arms and shoulders again.
Isn't this a fine old castle drone?
He said, leaning on the stone rail and taking another deep breath.
They know how to build castles, don't they?
I suppose they do, but Claff wasn't built by the Empire. They took it off another humanoid species who used to hold a ceremony similar to the one the Empire holds to crown the Emperor. But don't change the subject. I asked you a question. What is that style? You've been very vague and strange the past few days. I could see you were concentrating, so I didn't press the point. But I and the ship would like to be told.
Nikasar's taken on the part of the Empire, hence his style. I've had no choice but to become the culture, hence mine. It's that simple.
It doesn't look it.
Tough. Think of it as a sort of mutual rape.
I think you should straighten out, Jernar Gergely.
Gergely started to say, then stopped to check. He frowned in exasperation.
I'm perfectly straight, you idiot.
Now, why don't you do something useful and order me some breakfast?
Yes, master,
Fleer Imseho said sullenly, and dipped back inside the room. Gergely looked up into the empty board of blue sky, his mind already racing with plans for the game on the board of becoming. Fleer Imseho watched the man grow even more intense and absorbed in the days between the second and final games. He hardly seemed to hear anything that was said to him. He had to be reminded to eat and sleep. The drone wouldn't have believed it, but twice it saw the man sitting with an expression of pain on his face, staring at nothing. Doing a remote ultrasound scan, the drone had discovered the man's bladder was full to bursting. He had to be told when to pee. He spent all day, every day, gazing intently at nothing, or feverishly studying replays of old games, and though he might have been briefly undrugged after his long sleep, immediately thereafter he started glanding again and didn't stop. The drone used its effector to monitor the man's brainwaves and found that even when he appeared to sleep, it wasn't really sleep. Controlled, lucid dreaming was what it seemed to be. His drug glands were obviously working furiously all the time, and for the first time there were more telltale signs of intense drug use on Gergely's body than there were on his opponent's. How could he play in such a state? Had it been up to Fleer Imsaho, it would have stopped the man playing there and then. But it had its orders. It had a part to play. And it had played it. And all it could do now was wait and see what happened. More people attended the start of the game on the Border Becoming than had attended the previous two. The other game players were still trying to work out what was going on in this strange, complicated, unfathomable game, and wanted to see what would happen on this final board where the Emperor started with a considerable advantage, but on which the alien was known to be especially good. Gurge dived back into the game, an amphibian into welcoming water. For a few moves, he just gloried in the feeling of returning home to his element, and the sheer joy of the contest, taking delight in a flexing of his strengths and powers, the readying tension of the pieces and places. Then he curved out from that, playing to the serious business of the building and the hunting, the making and linking, and the destroying and cutting, the searching and destroying. The board became both culture and empire again. The setting was made by them both, a glorious, beautiful, deadly killing field, unsurpassably fine and sweet and predatory, and carved from Nikosar's beliefs and his together. Image of their minds. A hologram of pure coherence, burning like a standing wave of fire across the board. A perfect map of the landscapes of thought and faith within their heads. He began the slow move that